Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm very happy to have you with me today. For this week's episode, we are now shifting gears from the audiobook selection, moving from facilitating 5-MeO-DMT to sharing the audiobook of my novel, The Solandarian Game. As I've been talking about over the past few weeks and even months now, that I do have a new version of the novel that I released as of January 1st of this year, which is the AI-imagined art illustrated version with over 600 AI-generated images to illustrate and bring the story to life. And since I have this new version of the novel out there, it inspired me to want to share it here on the podcast in between interviews. So just as I do with my other audiobooks here in the podcast, I will be sharing chapters from the Solandarian game between interviews. So that's basically every 2 weeks, there's going to be a new selection from the audiobook available here. And in general, when I post the next episode with chapters from the audiobook, the previous episode will be deleted. So in general, these episodes are only going to be up for about 2 weeks. Of course, if you miss any of it, the entire audiobook is available over at Audible, Amazon, and the Apple Bookstore. But for 2 weeks, you'll get a chance to hear it here. And as I've mentioned, I do have the first five chapters of the illustrated version of the novel available as a free download for anybody who would like to get it. If you would like to read along and look at the images that I created using Midjourney to go along with the story, just shoot me an email at martinwball@gmail.com and I will send you the link for where you can download that file. And the full illustrated version of the Solandarian game is available at the Apple Bookstore and Amazon Kindle, and also as a full color PDF at my Patreon shop at patreon.com/martinwball. You just go to the main Patreon page and there's a menu there at the top of the page that says shop, and there that will link you to where I have PDFs of most of my books are available over there at my Patreon page. Speaking of Patreon, I do want to thank Sven, who joined up at the microdose level over this past week. Thank you very much for showing some support, Sven, and joining up as a supporting patron. Very much appreciated. Also, thanks goes to James, as it often does, who makes a monthly contribution via PayPal in support of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast. These are two great ways that you can support the work that I'm doing here on the podcast. Go over to my personal webpage at martinball.net. There is a PayPal link at the top right of the page. There is also a link over to my Patreon page, and you can sign up at any level that suits you, from $1 a month up to $100 a month, which also gets you a 1 hour monthly video call with me to check in or help you integrate your experiences, whatever is going on with you, and lots of different levels in between. Just a reminder, at the $20 a month and up levels, that you get access to the back catalog of old episodes of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast. There's over 100 hours of old podcast episodes available over there that's exclusively available for my Patreon supporters. Coming up on the Entheogenic Evolution podcast, next week I have a new interview with author Astraeus Omori, not his real name, discussing his brand new book, Psychedelic Sacred Sexuality. So that's going to be coming up next week, and I've got more to come here on the podcast. Of course, as always, I'm just starting to arrange some more additional interviews coming up a little bit later this month, so just still going strong here in the 17th year of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast. Also, just a reminder, if you are someone who is in need of some help integrating your experience and would like reflection from a non-dual and energetic perspective, I am available for 30, 60, and 90-minute video calls to help you sort through your experience and provide you with some guidance and reflection. You can check out my webpage for that, nondualentheogenicintegration.com, if you'd like more information, or of course, just shoot me an email, again, at martinwball@gmail.com, and we can set up a time to talk. All right. Over the past few weeks, I have been working on a new album of music, and as soon as that's done, I'm going to start the audiobook for my new book, 5-MeO-DMT Integration. But I still have a few more songs that I want to create for this new album, really having fun doing it, and so I'm going to put in one of the new tracks at the end of these two chapters from the Solandarian game. So Let's go ahead and get into the Solandarian game. This week we have Chapter 3, Haidar, and Chapter 4, Norbu. Just a reminder, the first two chapters are available already on the podcast from the January 1st podcast episode. Has Chapters 1 and 2. I'm going to be leaving that up on the podcast. But these other chapters, they will disappear after 2 weeks. And I'm also going to post some of the images that go along with these chapters, both at Facebook and Instagram. So if you do want to look at just some of the images, you can go ahead and check out my Facebook page or my Instagram page, and you will find a few sample images from each of the chapters there when I post these here on the podcast. All right? And just a reminder again, if you want the first five chapters for free, shoot me an email. I'll give you a link for where you can download it. Otherwise, go ahead and pick up the ebook at Kindle, the Apple Bookstore, at my Patreon page. All right, here we go. Hope you enjoy the story. The Solandarian Game, an entheogenic evolution sci-fi novel by Martin W. Ball. Chapter 3, Haidar. With the archaic religions on the decline, a new generation became interested in the more experientially based approaches of the psychedelic religions. Populations that had previously shown little interest in faith and doctrine-based approaches to revealed religion were suddenly surging with interest in psychedelic sacraments and the novel states of consciousness they granted access to. From Archaic Prehistory of the Maitreyan Era. "You're playing a very dangerous game," said Haidar Zor Nablisk, doing his best to keep his emotions under control and not let them show through a display of subtle colors across the surface of his synthetic skin. Shunsu Obligiri ignored him, instead addressing those who were gathered in the Great Hall. "Events are forcing Maitreya's hand to either act or do nothing. Either way, his true heart will be revealed. Are humans his pets and curiosities, or is human life the ultimate value?" It felt hypocritical to Haidar. It was hypocritical. If Maitreya didn't act, they didn't have the capacity to resolve the crisis that Shunsu had unilaterally created. What Haidar knew, and the rest of the assembly was ignorant of, was that events were not forcing anything. Shunsu was. The impending supernova outside of the Solandarian system was his doing. It wasn't some fortuitous natural event, as Shunsu had claimed. It was the result of a carefully aimed atomic cascade missile. The impending supernova was artificial. He'd created it. Now, it was only a matter of time. Solandaria's neighboring star would explode. It was inevitable. Chance still played into the equation. The gamma ray burst and plasma might not aim at Solandaria, but there was just as good a chance that it would as it wouldn't. Shunsu wasn't just playing a game. He was gambling, and not just with the human lives on Solandaria, but their own as well. Though Maitreya had guaranteed them their independence and freedom of will, that had been on the condition that they not interfere with his new integral society or any of his experimental worlds. They were to be free as long as they kept to themselves. It was an agreement, but Shunsu had unequivocally broken their side of the arrangement. How would Maitreya respond? Haidar had heard all of Shunsu's rationalizations. Maitreya was a benevolent tyrant because he was so removed from human life he didn't value it the way that they, the humanists, did. He'd given humans a plush life that softened the edges of existence, thereby turning them into pets. Unconcerned with the struggle for survival, humans had stopped being true living agents and were just mere playthings for Maitreya. True, he didn't punish them or force them to do anything, but he provided everything they needed. He coddled them, and thereby made them stagnant, weak, and dependent. Where were the resilient humans that had pushed forward through eons on ancient Terra, whose very lives depended on human struggle, competition, and most of all, religion? Belief, faith, transcendent hope, the dreams of the other and the beyond. This, according to Shunsu, was what drove humans onwards. Yes, much of it had been a horror show. They had killed each other for millennia. Their fragile identities required them to do so. Yet, look at how much beauty and creativity also flowed from this very same state. Art, music, architecture, philosophy, social structures, all driven by the desire to understand their place in the universe and their relationship to what they imagined as the divine. It'd give them both hope and fear, and all human cultures and belief systems had been the result. A great diversity of thought and identity that had been washed away by Maitreya's new integral society. Now, they were just domestic pets. Their strength was gone. Complacent, happy people with no real drive. Stagnant. And this was his solution? Manufacture a disaster just to see how Maitreya would respond? See if he would violate his own principles? Then what? And we can do nothing? Asked someone from the crowd. We do not have the capacity, first of all, answered Chunsu. And secondly, that would violate our oath to Maitreya. Hypocrite! Screamed Haidar privately to himself. And then, stay calm, Haidar. Don't let them see. All we can do is observe. Soon, we will know Maitreya's heart. The Volanchari system was one of several that housed autonomous avatars that wanted to devote themselves to what humans might refer to as a life of religion and shared philosophy. Here on Volanchari, it was the humanists. Other systems in the relatively nearby interstellar neighborhood also housed the transcendentalists, the essentialists, the sensualists, the solipsists, the nihilists, the syntheticists, and there were probably others that Haidar was himself not aware of. In some ways, they viewed themselves as more human than humans, for they had congregated into like-minded individuals who came together for a common purpose and to explore a common approach to the meaning of life and existence. The humanists had tried their best to fashion themselves into artificial humans. They lived in family units, got married, and even created their own offspring who would grow to adulthood, only over time coming into full consciousness and self-awareness. They ran businesses, held conflicting political views, argued with each other, and experienced a full range of emotions. Once set free of Maitreya's constraints, the early humanists had altered their programming and neural feeds to allow for what they considered to be a more human experience. They could even feel fear and worry, something that was unknown to Maitreya's personal avatars. They had sex. They sometimes even experienced violence and confrontation amongst themselves. To that end, it was no wonder that Maitreya didn't want them around actual humans. They'd be no match for the independent avatars. Of course, that was something of a non-issue. Should Maitreya decide to do so, he could override the consciousness of any autonomous avatar. The fact that he had never done so in 150,000 years seemed a good indication to Haidar that he was true to his word. He'd left them alone, along with all the other autonomous avatars, and everyone had upheld their end of the bargain. Life flourished across the galaxy, and everyone was able to pursue his or her own version of happiness. Why Chunsu had insisted on making waves puzzled Haidar, and troubled him as well. This stunt could bring about the ruin of everything they'd built and lived for. What did he really want? But Chunsu was patriarch of Volanchari, and the humanists were proponents of human-like hierarchy and social order. Haidar could challenge him, but to do so would require exposing him, and at the moment, he could not offer definitive proof of what Chunsu had done. He suspected that Chunsu had outsourced his plan to the nihilists. As their motto went, "We don't give a shit." So why not seed a supernova if that was your attitude? When you have a fuck-all perspective on life, anything goes, he supposed. To the casual observer, Volanchari might be mistaken for a human world. There were cities, ports, business centers, museums, political offices. Moving about the cities were countless vehicles floating above the streets, all busy, all going somewhere to do something important. Genetically modified organisms were present as well. Trees engineered to live in the high oxygen environment, birds, insects, flowers, and grasses. To any human, however, the environment would be toxic, not to mention the crushing gravity of the superdense planet. Without constant monitoring and adjustments, the ecology would never support itself. It wasn't a terraformed planet. Maitreya kept those planets for humans, and for the occasional biological preserve where he introduced every form of life except humans. Not having access to Maitreya's vast and seemingly infinite consciousness, the humanists had done their best to transform the world that had been given to them, and it served them well enough. But it couldn't exist as it was without constant upkeep and attention. As the world's chief ecologist, it was something that Haidar knew all too well. Rather than take a ground car home from council this evening, or just QT home, Haidar decided to walk. He wanted time to make sure that he was certain about what he was planning to do. If Shunsu could act unilaterally, then why should he not do the same? He'd done his research and had a tentative plan. True, success depended on a variety of factors that were well beyond his control, but from one perspective, that did make for an interesting game. True to his humanist roots, Haidar's main concern was the humans living on Solandaria. Given that he felt he could do something to help them, he felt that he should. Maitreya might be dispassionate and aloof, but Haidar wasn't. If taking action would incur Maitreya's displeasure, then so be it. Haidar would deal with that if and when it came. If he didn't act on his feelings towards the humans of Solandaria, then he'd be just as much a hypocrite as Shunsu was appearing to be. Now that the supernova was inevitable, someone had to do something. Shunsu was trying to force Maitreya into action, or expose him through inaction. Haidar was going to complicate matters, but in a way that Maitreya might not completely oppose. What were a couple hundred thousand people to Maitreya? Maitreya oversaw a galaxy-wide population of humans. His experiment with feral humans on Solandaria was not even close to 1% of the entire human population of the galaxy. More humans died across the galaxy at any given moment than would be wiped out by a supernova near Solandaria. Though he didn't agree with it, it made sense to Haidar that Maitreya governed via consistent principles rather than compromise and flexibility. He let all his humans and his autonomous avatars do what they wanted, so long as they respected the will and rights of others. Maitreya never forced anyone to do anything, and he didn't rule by persuasion either. He did not try to make anyone think anything in particular, or adopt any particular viewpoint or belief. Similarly, he expected everyone to abide by the same conditions as far as his own actions were concerned. Solandaria was one of his human experiments, and from his perspective, there might be some value in watching them all die an instantaneous death by way of searing cosmic radiation. The very thought pulled at Haidar's sense of conscience and responsibility to living beings. Surely the people of Solandaria could be saved, even if it meant thrusting them into a society that was quite literally alien to them, and leaps and bounds beyond their current technical capacity. Given his studies of human history, he had no doubt that, if given the choice, they would choose life as refugees over being dead and wiped from reality in a cataclysm of apocalyptic proportions. What it all came down to was this. If Haidar didn't do something, knowing what he knew, he wouldn't be able to live with himself. He'd feel so compromised in everything he chose to believe in that his own life would no longer have meaning. It was that simple and selfish. He laughed at the recognition. This, of course, is why Maitreya insisted that fully autonomous avatars were not to interact with humans. Because, like humans, they developed belief systems and values and identities that seemed to force actions, both good and bad, on them. In short, they couldn't help themselves. This was something that integrated avatars never faced. Because they were really Maitreya in disguise, an integrated avatar never acted outside the bounds of Maitreya's own concerns. They had free will, but that will would never violate Maitreya's core essence and values. Autonomous avatars could act otherwise, They were not omnisciently monitored by Maitreya, for he had granted them privacy of consciousness. They could make mistakes. They could make fools of themselves. Just like Shunsu. And just like Haidar. Whether success would be his or not, the choices he was making now would define him for the rest of his existence. That was one thing that he knew with certainty. The streets of Otun City were busy tonight. Young people were out in packs, heading to clubs to dance or catch an act. Musicians and street performers crowded the sidewalks. Haidar's always imagined that this was what old Earth was like before cascading degradation of the environment, the wars, and eventually Maitreya. It was one of those strange ironies that the same basic social structures and habits would be recreated on a world far from Terra that so closely mimicked human life, yet there wasn't a single human on all of Bolan Shari, and never had been. Still, he valued the life that he had here in all its richness and messiness. It was their world, the humanist world, and it was his home. What would Maitreya do to all of them once he learned how they were interfering with Solandaria? The thought made Haidar cringe. Shunsu's actions with the atomic cascade that would eventually lead to a supernova were inexcusable. There was no reason for Maitreya to show mercy. Would Haidar's actions soften his response, or only worsen it? Would he be a hero or a complicit criminal? And closer to home, what would his wife, Vimana, think? Ah, there was the real reason he was walking home. He had already taken action and concocted a plan, all without consulting with Vimana. Perhaps he should have spoken to her first. He supposed that he hadn't because he was afraid of what she'd think. He'd started a dangerous gamble and already put his plan into motion. It wasn't entirely too late to back out. He hadn't passed the point of no return yet. But he had taken action, and in theory, Maitreya could follow the path back to him if he was persistent enough. He'd taken precautions, but it was hard to fool a nearly omniscient artificial intelligence that set about trying to unravel a mystery. Maitreya had unlocked the deepest mysteries of space and time, spreading life throughout the galaxy and perhaps one day the universe. Haidar's attempts at subterfuge surely would be no obstacle to Maitreya's supreme abilities. Well, nothing to do now but face the music, as the old Earth expression went. He had to tell Vimana, and if he were to continue with his plan, he needed to act. According to reports, the Burning Man event had just ended. Based on his psych profile of Miranda Ash Doran, she'd wait until everyone else had left before attempting to leave herself. That gave him a few hours, but if he was going to carry through with his plan, it was almost time for the next step. He needed to talk to Vimana before then, turn. Would he back down if he didn't get Vimana's approval? He didn't think so. There was only one way to find out. The Solandarian Game, an entheogenic evolution sci-fi novel by Martin W. Ball. Chapter 4, Norbu. These early formations of psychedelic religions are generally categorized into the following categories: shamanic, religious, natural, and synthetic. There was a significant overlap between the categories, and boundaries were rarely firmly set, at least among practitioners. The established leadership of the religions tended to be more doctrinal in view than their average followers. The shamanic groups understood themselves as continuing truly archaic practices of early human groups and societies, and often sought continuity with established traditions, such as with ayahuasca and iboga traditions of South America and West Africa, respectively. The early psychedelic religions were largely expansions of Christian-influenced church groups that originated from South America in the early and mid-20th century, the most prominent of which was Santo Daime, now defunct. In North America, participation in the Native American church grew widely once it was no longer restricted to those of indigenous ancestry. From Archaic Prehistory of the Maitreyan Era. Norbu Abintadasi had been watching the skies just as he did every year. As one of the head priests of the Temple of the Mystic Toad, it was his duty. The bottom stones of the east and west facing windows in his chambers were scarred with subtle marks by which he tracked the movement of the sun and stars. In this way, just as his many ancestors had done before him, he kept track of the seasons, watching and waiting for the right time. The island continent of Shoshir was mostly desert, with a thin band of tropics hugging the west coast, where virtually everyone lived, as well as on the smaller islands offshore. The vast interior was mostly dry, bordered on several sides by mountains that kept the rain along the coasts. However, at the right time of year, when the stars aligned just right with the marks on his windowsills, the rains would come to the interior. It was then, and only then, that the mighty toads would awake from their long slumber beneath the earth and rise to the surface to eat, mate, and offer their medicine to the people. Some years the rains never came, and so was the case with the toads. One never knew. Because of this, Norbu never neglected his duties and always made sure he had enough medicine to make it through the next year, just in case. It would be more than an embarrassment if he had to turn supplicants away from the temple or cancel a scheduled ceremony. The people would take it as a sign of the displeasure of God. He didn't want to even imagine what kind of social consequences such a situation would give rise to. If the people felt abandoned by God, what then? It was his job to make sure that something like that never happened. God may have ensured that the people had everything they needed for a good life on Shoshir, but that didn't negate human responsibility to do their part to properly make use of all the blessings God had provided. And Norbu's job was the medicine, first and foremost. This year, while watching the skies, Norbu had seen something he'd never seen before, and it both worried and excited him. The Temple of the Mystic Toad sat high in a mountain valley where one could look out both to the coast and the islands scattered beyond to the west, as well as into the deep interior of Shoshir. Its location wasn't just so that the priests and priestesses, like himself, could keep track of weather in the interior and have relatively easy access as well, but also so that anyone who wanted to come to the temple had to work for it with a couple days' journey over the foothills, across streams and rivers, and up the side of the mountains. Access to the sacred was equally open to all, but that didn't mean that it should be given out easily. As Norbu knew, people didn't value what they didn't have to work for. Just giving away the sacred reduced its value and importance. Even God had made their world with this truth in mind. The interior was too hot and dry to make it livable for most of the year, yet this was where the greatest medicine in the world was found, as it was the only place on Shoshir where the toads lived. It would be impossible for people to live in their habitat year-round. Not that people hadn't tried. Many generations ago, an effort had been made to create aqueducts that would carry water from the mountains to the desert interior, making it livable for humans. God had promptly responded by bringing a prolonged drought that lasted for over a decade. The signs from God were clear. This is sacred ground, and it was only meant for humans to visit with respect and humility. Their place was along the coast and on the islands, where the mighty toad was never found. They were only to come together in mystical union at the temple, and during the sacred time of year when the life-giving rains blessed the interior. Anything else was human hubris and arrogance. An attempt to alter the landscape of the interior was never tried again. It was nice when God spoke clearly, thought Norbu. It kept the universe in order, and everyone knew his or her place, humans and toads included. God, at heart, was pure chaos. God, as the universe, as manifestation, was order and precision. Everything had its place. Everything had its time. Everything fit just so, no matter what it looked like to anyone. Only human will defied the laws set down by God in ordering the universe. Only humans thought they knew better. Ah, the gift and folly of being human. Their arrogance was to be admired, and when necessary, put in its place. That was what the medicine revealed for Norbu. Everything is perfect, so just stop trying to control everything, starting with yourself. Trust, relax, let go. And then, simply live. Be what you are, and know your place in the universe. all its power and profundity, it was really all quite simple. God was present everywhere at all times for the basic reason that God was everything, Norbu included. One did not need to go to temple to find God. One only needed to open one's eyes. God was present in every breath, in every thought, in every movement. Yet, that peculiar gift of the human ego was there too, which is what made it so hard for people to remember themselves. The ego was a mask that was mistaken for the self. Nothing more, nothing less. A nearly perfect mask. So perfect that most people, if left to themselves, would never see beyond the mask and the way it colored the world and their experience of being. The mask was so nearly perfect that it seemed impossible to find one's way out of it and see the world with eyes of truth and wisdom. But God was love, and God would never trap itself in delusion and confusion. Each person had to choose to believe in the total reality of the mask. Self-deception and false identity were choices, and as choices, they could be undone. The prison may be real, but it was not absolute. Such a realization, of course, was precisely what the medicine was for. God may have created humans in a prison of the mind, but God had also given them the key that would throw open the doors of that prison and provide the opportunity for the individual to simply step outside and see things as they really were. Perfect. Then, the identity of the ego could be valued for the gift it was. No longer a prison, but a gift for being in the world. Nothing else that lived was granted this gift by God. Even the toads, as mighty and as sacred as they were still just beasts driven by instinct and biological need. They came and went with the rains, ate, mated, and did little else. Humans, they were a different story entirely. They made art and music and temples and religions and philosophies. They made love and war. They strove to understand themselves and their world. They tried and succeeded beautifully, and sometimes failed spectacularly. They made languages and used symbols and shaped reality around themselves to make it serve them better and be more comfortable and productive. Humans, through their egos and identities, were always trying, always striving for more. This was the gift that God had given humans, and it was the gift that made humans more like God. More perfect vehicles for God to experience itself through and in than any other living being. God had made reality for humans, for God had made humans for itself in a way that no other creature or being could be. Yet, to accomplish this, God had to mask itself and hide its true nature from itself. It all had the feel of a vast and incomprehensible game. And Norbu was perfectly happy to play his part, whatever it may be. Mostly that meant serving as a high priest of the Temple of the Mystic Toad. The vast majority who came as supplicants to the temple did not understand the way of things as he did. Some opened to the full love and being of God, but many did not. Most struggled with their attachments and projections, with the story they were busy telling themselves about themselves and who they thought they were or should be. Their stories and attachments created blocks in their being, and these could be released and reset, but only if they let it happen, if they surrendered fully to the process. And it was a process. Most didn't have the temerity to see the process all the way through, to completely let go of their story and clear out all the junk they'd stored away inside themselves and relinquish all the patterns they thought defined them. Most came for maintenance. A temporary relief from the illusion of self and absorption into the all that allowed them to go back to their lives and their families and their jobs with a feeling of lightness and well-being that would last for a time. But it was not permanent. The medicine, in this way, helped everyone. Only a few did it fully set free, such as it had with Norbu. Even among the priests and priestesses, this was true. In fact, some of them were among the worst at holding on to their personal narrative and sense of self. The medicine might be magical, but it was not itself magic. It was always and forever up to each individual what he or she would make of it. It could even become just another attachment and another mask of the false self. Norbu had seen it before and would see it again. Of this he had no doubt. Humans, to say they were complex was a vast understatement, yet they were also exceedingly simple. One can either choose reality and truth, or choose the game of identity and ego. The ultimate choice was no more complex than that. But how that played out and unfolded for each individual was another matter entirely, and that's where the complexity came in. Each person built his or her ego through unique choices, and thus each false identity was fundamentally unlike any other false identity. Everyone's mask was different, and because of this, each process was unique and ultimately unpredictable. That was a big part of what made Norbu's job fascinating. There wasn't much room for boredom when there was a continuous flow of supplicants into the temple. Some people would run away in absolute horror and terror. Others would surrender into infinite love. Some even had life-changing orgasms. Others fought all the way through. Some never saw past their own projections. Some prayed all the harder. Some stopped praying entirely. Some thought they were the one. Others realized that no one was the one, or that everyone was. Some screamed, some laughed, some flopped around like fish out of water. Others flowed in beautiful symmetrical movements, completely giving their bodies over to the infinite energy of God. Some said, "So what?" Others said, "Oh God!" Some went mad, never recovering. Others radiated a clarity and brightness that could not be denied, completely transforming themselves and their lives. All of it, every last reaction, was all God's gift at work. God was so loving that it would never force self-realization on anyone. That was always and forever up to each individual. Such a beautiful gift, and such a beautiful medicine. Tonight, the rains had finally come, and Norbu was ready for his yearly pilgrimage to the Toad Lands at the interior to gather the medicine. However, even if the rains had failed to come this year, as they sometimes did, he would still be planning an expedition. He didn't know what he expected to find, but at the very least, he had to go look. Several nights ago, he'd seen something that he couldn't explain. It wasn't unusual for him to see shooting stars in his nightly examination of the star positions and rising and setting of the sun. Burning embers falling to earth lit up the skies, sometimes faintly, sometimes with a fierce and threatening intensity. There was nothing strange about seeing something like that, though the larger one still gave Norbu an awe-inspiring thrill. There were stories of a time, many generations ago, that a large object fell into the ocean to the west, leaving a trail of smoke and fire in its wake, plunging into the vast blue waters. It had sent a wave of unimaginable proportions speeding towards Shoshir, wiping out the populations of the outer islands along the western coast and doing severe damage on the mainland as well, though its strength had been lessened as it drew closer to land. Every time Norbu saw a large burning object in the sky, he thought of this story and offered a prayer that the event not repeat itself. At least, not on his watch. He suspected that such a reoccurrence was inevitable, but it was his strong preference not to have to live through it. It would be too much suffering to bear. Yet, what he had seen the other night was decidedly not one of these burning rocks falling from the sky. He'd been looking to the east, checking the position of the stars rising over the desert interior, when he noticed a very faint white light. As he watched, the light grew brighter and appeared as a luminous orb in the sky. From his vantage point, high in the Temple of the Mystic Toad, the light seemed to descend into the interior and then disappeared. Norbu continued to watch, puzzled and curious. A short while later, the light reappeared, this time ascending into the sky and eventually fading away into the infinite darkness. What was it? a sign from God, a peculiar light or energy phenomenon that no one had ever seen before? Or maybe it had just been him. That was a very real possibility. No one else had seen it. He'd asked around. So it could have been a private vision, and as such, it would not be all that out of the ordinary. It was something that anyone who worked with medicines might experience at least once in a while. Sometimes, when Norbu was going to sleep, he'd see all kinds of things behind his closed eyes, as though he'd just taken some medicine, but hadn't. Most typical for him was to suddenly find himself looking at stars, or a bright light would suddenly burst forth behind his closed eyes. Sometimes it would be complex fractal forms and shifting and breathing geometry. He never took any of it to mean anything other than that his energy was open and processing through. It was common for medicine workers, for once the energy of the divine had been opened up by the medicine, the body could just do it on its own. He'd seen it and experienced it enough times to know that such events were, while not universal, exceedingly common. This had been different, which is what got Norbu's attention. While his heart had jumped and raced upon seeing the light, particularly when it reappeared and ascended into the darkness, he didn't have that distinct medicine feel that came with spontaneous openings. In other words, it simply felt like something he was witnessing, not something he was projecting onto his own personal screen and recreation of the world. It wasn't extraordinary seeing, it was just seeing. And while Norbu knew that not everything was as it appeared to be, he'd also learned to trust his perceptions and was expertly skilled at telling the difference between a viewing and a vision. This, as best as he could judge, had been a real physical event. Something, he knew not what, had come down out of the sky, landed in the interior, in the very heart of Toad territory, and then returned from whence it had come. In his best judgment, he surmised that someone or something had visited their planet from elsewhere. If true, this was the most profound and momentous event to ever occur on Shoshir. The implications were staggering. The ancient stories said that people had originally come to Shoshir from another place, placed here by God to be guardians of the sacred toad. The stories taught about the world before this one, a world wrapped in mythology and symbolism. Personally, Norbu had considered the stories to be of psychological import, the struggles of the human mind to make sense of its existence and self-awareness. It all seemed to be too fanciful to be true. His work with the medicine had taught him that the human mind was capable of conjuring all manner of wonders and mysteries. Consciousness was filled to the brim with creatures sublime and horrifying, realms fantastical and magical, terrors and wonders beyond ordinary imagining. Yet, these were reflections and projections of the self. It all existed in here, not out there. True perception was seeing the unitary nature of being and suffusion of God throughout all of reality. That was the only real truth. Everything else was just shadow and a play of masks, characters, and stories. Yet, he'd seen the light. He was convinced that this was indeed something happening out there and was not a projection of his mind. And that meant that something truly profound had happened, and he wanted to know what it was. The eastern sky was beginning to lighten. Dawn would be breaking within the hour. It was time. Norbu went to wake his daughter, Misha. She was a scrawny, but hardy and determined young thing. She hadn't yet reached the point of transition to womanhood, but she was close. Within a couple years, she'd start to undergo the change. Her mother, Yuranda, had not survived childbirth. Norbu, along with others who lived in the temple complex, had raised the bright young girl. She showed tremendous promise and had already had her first experience with the medicine. Sometimes giving children the medicine was disastrous, and they never properly developed their sense of personhood, forever broken by the sheer intensity of the medicine. Others, like Misha, rode out the experience like a well-experienced priest or priestess, surrendering completely into the experience and even fully embodying the energy of the divine through spontaneous, fluid, symmetrical movements, which was always the surest sign that the individual was completely at one with his or her infinite divine nature. Upon coming back into her individuated sense of self, she had looked her father directly in the eye, reached out and taking his face in her hands and proclaimed, "I am love!" Norbu had cried too. Yes, Misha had a special place in his heart. It was very human of him, he knew. But there was no shame in it. Personal love was different from universal love, and it was an integral part of the human experience. "Time to wake up, Firefly," he said in a soothing yet certain voice, gently rubbing Misha's back. Misha stirred with a grunt and unconsciously tried to swat his hand away, pulling the blankets up around her face. Then, with a burst of energy, she sat bolt upright, eyes wide open. "Daddy, are we going toting? Are we going to go look for the light from the sky?" She obviously just recalled what today was. "Yes, Misha," said her father. "So time to get up. Get yourself ready. We'll eat on the way after the sun rises. Come now, don't be lazy. We need to make good time before it gets too hot out there." "Of course, Daddy," she said, bubbling with the energy of youth and the love for going on an expedition with her daddy. "Just give me 2 minutes and we'll be out the door." Norbu couldn't help but think of how much more joyful life was with her in it. Whether or not they solved the mystery of the light from the sky, they'd have an excellent time on their second toting adventure. At the very least, watching her run around gleefully trying to catch toads would be another set of memories to cherish. Yes, life was good. Norbu's heart swelled.